While today's four Pentagon services have their own identities and cultures, they train together and they fight together in ways they did not a quarter century ago. Joint commands and defense agencies bring the military services together to seamlessly perform missions on behalf of a unified Pentagon. The most prominent and powerful military figures are the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the regional combatant commanders. It wasn't always that way, though. 25 years ago, the power centers were the military services and the service chiefs. Defense reform advocates at the time said those service-centric stovepipes led to an unhealthy competition for resources and effectively prohibited the services from operating jointly, and it kept the Joint Chiefs from offering timely and relevant military advice to the president. Various studies had been pointing out those shortcomings for decades, but the issue never got traction in Congress until the early 1980s. Rudy De Leon, a former Undersecretary of Defense who served as a staff member on the House Armed Services Committee in the 80s, says that's when some operational failures finally got Congress to focus attention on the arcane topic of the Pentagon's organizational chart.
One is the failure of the U.S. effort to get to the hostages in Iran in 1980, where the elements of the military rescue were only coming together when they were actually flying the mission into Tehran. The second big event was the bombing against the U.S. Marine peacekeepers in Beirut, Lebanon in 1983.
Also in the early 80s, Congress heard a call for reform from someone with a credible voice on the matter, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff himself. Jim Locker, the former Senate Armed Services Committee staffer who shepherded Goldwater Nichols through Congress, says in February 1982, the chairman fired the first shot in a four-year battle to reform the Pentagon.
David Jones, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, beginning in 1978, is such a hero because he broke ranks with the military brotherhood and went to Capitol Hill and said the system was broken and appealed to the Congress to fix it.
Locker, who wrote a comprehensive history of Goldwater Nichols called Victory on the Potomac, says Jones viewed his testimony to a closed session of the House Armed Services Committee as the start of a holy war. He and Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger were there to discuss the DoD budget. Instead, to Weinberger's surprise, Jones gave an 8-minute statement on the ineffectiveness of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Jones had already approached Weinberger with his reform ideas and hadn't gotten anywhere. If the 45 members of the House Armed Services Committee were surprised, though, they didn't show it. 4 hours of questions and testimony went by without any significant attention to the bombshell Jones had just dropped.
This was not a subject that the Congress was really familiar with. It did not examine defense organization.
Finally, the questions came around to a fourth-term congressman from Missouri, Ike Skelton.
And I remember very well, General Jones was telling how the Joint Chiefs of Staff doesn't work and that they would give pablum advice, lowest common denominator advice, and as I recall, that was usually the Navy. And he really became a pariah among senior leadership of the military because of that.
Besides Skelton, Jones' testimony got the attention of an influential House Armed Services Committee staffer named Arch Barrett, a retired Army lieutenant colonel and a student of defense organization. The following year, with a new Congress, Alabama Congressman Bill Nichols took charge of the investigation subcommittee, and Barrett persuaded him to put Pentagon reform at the top of the legislative agenda. They continued to hold hearings on the issue. The panel started examining whether the Pentagon's organizational structure was at fault for some recent military catastrophes, like the failed Iranian hostage rescue and the bombing of the Marine Corps barracks in Beirut. Skelton says one of Nichols' hearings was held on board a ship just off the Lebanese coast.
And he discovered that from the Pentagon to the Marine colonel in charge of the Marines there were 22 links, you know, in the chain of command. And he got very interested in the subject, thank goodness.
In 1983, Skelton, who later became chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, proposed a reform bill that would become one of the precursors to Goldwater Nichols.
And I introduced legislation that abolished the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I found out that none of them had a sense of humor.
Skelton's idea at the time was to replace the chiefs with a National Military Council, a group of advisors made up of senior uniformed and civilian personnel that would advise the president but would have no military authority. Skelton says it got the chiefs' attention and let them know Congress was serious about Pentagon reform. They responded, Skelton says, by doing everything they could to derail the effort.
Every service chief, with the exception of one, really said some unkind words to me about my efforts. The CNO at the time, along with other service chiefs, met with six of us House members, he said that what you're doing is downright unpatriotic. And Bill Nichols, who lost a leg or a part of a leg in Germany during the Second World War, said, "Admiral, I resent your calling us unpatriotic and unbraided even." It was an unpleasant situation with him.
Over the chief's objections, the House would pass reform bills three times in the early to mid-80s. Each time, they died in the Senate, where the chairman of that chamber's Armed Services Committee saw no need for reform. That was the case until 1985, when Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater took over as chairman and Georgia Senator Sam Nunn became the ranking Democrat. Again, Jim Locker.
Besides General Jones, that partnership between Senator Goldwater and Senator Nunn was the second most important factor in the passage of Goldwater-Nichols.
Goldwater and Nunn began holding hearings in 1985. Meanwhile, Locker and other Senate Armed Services staffers were already working on a detailed two-year study of the organizational problems at DOD. The committee released their staff report that October, and by then, for Goldwater, the question wasn't whether DOD needed to be reorganized, it was how. At a hearing, he told Defense Secretary Cap Weinberger to get ready for reform.
There are people around town that don't think we're serious about this, that this is just another political gesture. I want to assure you that we're going to do this. It's our responsibility according to the Constitution. And I think personally it's the most important thing that this Armed Services Committee of the Senate has ever undertaken. I only have one more year in this body, and I made the statement that it's the most important task I've ever undertaken, and I'm not going to leave here with this thing dragging feet. So I just want you to get the idea that we're serious about this, so you might as well tell your boys over there to get ready, because we're going to do all we can to help you reorganize.
Nunn was equally committed, but both he and Goldwater knew it would be an uphill climb. Opposition from inside DOD was still very strong, and the two senators were on shaky ground in their own committee. This is Nunn speaking to reporters in October 1985.
The odds are always against making major changes in an existing organization, and Department of Defense is no exception to that. And anytime you're dealing with a military organization, it's even more difficult. I would say because the leadership of Senator Goldwater and because the House of Representatives has already addressed these issues and moving forward, that the odds are less against making changes now than they have been in the past, but they're still against it.
By February of 1986, Goldwater and Nunn were ready to start debate on a reform bill. Before they presented it to their committee, they arranged a meeting at the Pentagon with the chiefs in the tank, the Joint Chiefs meeting room. The senators knew they would get opposition, but they were taken aback by what they heard. Locker was in the room for the meeting. By his account, the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps chiefs told Goldwater and Nunn that their bill would do irreparable harm to national security, that it would turn combatant commanders into warlords, that it would undermine civilian control of the military.
This was quite an unusual session because normally the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be quite deferential to the chairman and the ranking Democrat on the Armed Services Committee. But this was a no-holds-bar kind of discussion between them where they were quite critical. And I thought that they may want to delay and strengthen their position. But in fact, it just increased their determination that this was something that was going to have to be enacted by Congress to make these fundamental changes in the Pentagon. And so they decided to press ahead.
Press ahead they did. And Goldwater and Nunn managed to change a lot of minds on their committee, in part by putting a halt to all other committee activity until the bill was considered. The Goldwater-Nichols legislation went from having a razor-thin margin of support in 1985 to getting a 19-0 unanimous vote to pass the legislation out of the Senate Armed Services Committee in March of 1986. 2 months later, it passed the full Senate 95-0. By August, the House had approved similar legislation, and in October, it got President Ronald Reagan's signature. 25 years later, not even the military service chiefs advocate a return to the pre-Goldwater-Nichols days when the services reigned supreme. Senator Lindsey Graham asked each of the chiefs at a hearing last month, just to make sure.
Let's talk about Goldwater-Nichols. How many of you believe it works? Who believes it doesn't work? Speak up. Nobody. All right.
Graham raised the issue to call the chiefs to task for opposing a modern-day reform, giving the National Guard a seat on the Joint Chiefs. Both houses of Congress have now agreed to that idea over the unanimous objection of the current chiefs. As to the Goldwater-Nichols reforms, Locker, who also served as an assistant secretary of defense in the 1990s, says they're not just accepted by the current chiefs, they quickly became a part of the culture of the military, from top to bottom.
You know, today, people wonder how in the world we didn't do this earlier than 1986. That just seems so natural to them. And if you go out into the field, if you go to the combatant commands, they are thinking joint at every moment. That service parochialism has completely disappeared. And people are just amazed at how those organizations are unified.
In part two of our series, we'll explore how DOD made the transition to the post-Goldwater-Nichols era, what some of the specific improvements were, and some suggestions for further national security reform 25 years after Goldwater-Nichols. In Washington, I'm Jared Serbu, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.